you very much once again for making this possible. My wife is very grateful that I eat lunch on Wednesdays. Once a week, I'll make sure that I eat well. Thank you. I also want to make sure to thank Stuart Haber for making it. Stuart is the executive director of Yeshiva University Canada, and one of the people who keeps the lights on in my Beit Midrash. So,
and chicks are welcome to us.
Okay. The topic, as requested, is ransoming captives held by ISIS. This is a topic with which Jews have a very long history, going back a couple of thousand years in terms of the issue of ransoming captives. But I want to highlight a particular case that I brought you in the first source. Everyone has the papers? Okay. And that is, as you see there, it's titled Terror in Black September. The article is specifically Terror in Black September, an eyewitness account. This is usually known as either Black September or the Dawson's Field hijacking. Anyone here remember this? This was 1970, so it's a while back. But it was a coordinated hijacking of multiple airlines, taking them to Jordan. There was one attempt to hijack an El Al jet that was foiled, and instead they took another jet, and it was too large, and it couldn't land on the airfield, on the runway at Dawson's Field, and they redirected somewhere else. But Dawson's Field was an old air base in Jordan. And this was done, I think it was the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. I think they're the ones who did it. And it was at the time not only an issue for Jews and Israelis, in particular, and what I mean by that is that they actually they split off the hostages and they freed one group and they held the Jews and Israelis. But also, it was an issue for the Jordanians at the time because it was part of the general revolt of the Palestinians within Jordan against the Hashemite government. So there were layer upon layer going on here. But among the hostages being held was Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner. Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner was the Rosh Yeshiva of, the head of, the Chaim Berlin Yeshiva in New York, a very prominent yeshiva. He was considered one of the world's leading Torah scholars. And he's there among the hostages. And so the question arose among his students, should we make a special effort, translation, raise money for ransom, to get him released? If you take a look at the first source, this is just an interesting piece that I found relating to the whole event. The scene is the Allenby Bridge across the Jordan River, 11:30 a.m. I do not remember what day. A lone U.S. Embassy official walked up to the Allenby Bridge, an unimpressive steel and wooden structure spanning the Jordan River at a narrow point between Israel and Jordan. He carried a box marked, quote, special foods for the Red Crescent, Amman. Inside were canned Israeli goods and a note that read kosher food for Rabbi Huttner. 2 days earlier, the American Embassy in Amman learned that Rabbi Isaac Huttner, a strict adherent to the dietary laws of Judaism, has refused to accept food which he believes to be not kosher. In fact, 8 other hostages, including me, David Rabb, the author of the article, were doing the same. The embassy asked other U.S. embassies in the region to, quote, obtain canned kosher items and forward them to Amman as soon as possible for relay to the captors. The next day, the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv offered to do so. The Amman embassy advised it to deliver the food in, quote, inconspicuous packages to the Jordanian police at the Allenby Bridge and requested that it be turned over to the ICRC in Amman. Now, as the article plays out, it turns out no one had coordinated with the ICRC, and therefore they didn't show up to pick up the food, and the result is it never came through. The food actually never got there. But the special attention that was paid to this Rabbi Huttner testifies to his importance and the fact that he was recognized as being of particular value among the hostages. And in fact, there were those who wanted to raise the funds to ransom him. And they conferred with rabbinic authorities to ask the question of, is this appropriate? Should we be paying whatever sum they demand in order to free him? As I said, we actually have a long history of dealing with this issue of hostage taking. There is, in fact, a hierarchy among the acts of tzedakah, of philanthropy, within Judaism, and the highest ranking type of philanthropy is what's called in Hebrew, you may know the phrase, pidyon shvuyim, right, redeeming of captives. It goes technically back to biblical times. Who's the first captive in the Bible?
Lot.
Right. Lot, Sarah's brother, Lot, is taken captive. There are others, of course, as you work through it, but it really obtains its high place in Jewish law in the period of the Romans, because it was standard in those days for people to take others hostage, and we're talking illegally. We're talking about highwaymen, basically, grabbing people and holding them for ransom and saying, if you don't pay the ransom, then we're going to sell them on the slave market. That was the way it worked. So what you were essentially doing by ransoming captives was you were buying people back from the Romans. It continues from there. It was a very big issue in the era of the Crusades. It was a big issue during the time of expulsions from various countries in Europe. The most famous case is probably the case of the Maharam Meir Rothenburg, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, leader of the Jews of Germany in the 13th century. Was kidnapped. What happened was, first he tried to flee Germany. It was a hostile place for Jews. And he, along with some followers, tried to flee. This was in the year 1286. He was caught and imprisoned for life in a fortress. And there was an attempt by the Jewish community to ransom him. And he argued that you're not allowed to ransom him. He refused to be ransomed. And he died in the prison. They ended up ransoming his body instead.
Yeah. Was it a function of the fact that he chose not to be ransomed, or he chose not to be ransomed for the sum that they were pushing?
So that's part of what we have to talk about. Good question. Moving ahead, we find this in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. Another very interesting case. Don Isaac of Barbanel was a leader of the Jews at the end of the 15th century in Spain. He was high up in the government. During the expulsion in 1492, he left along with the Jews, although technically he actually had the right to stay. His son wanted to leave as well, and they didn't want his son to leave. His son was a respected physician. And so the Spanish seized his year-old son, Isaac. They held him hostage and baptized him and raised him as Christian. The year 1648, 1649, another low point in Jewish history, when the Cossacks were killing thousands in the Ukraine, and once again you find them holding communities, and there you're talking about thousands of people, literally. They hold them for ransom by other communities. So this is something that unfortunately has come up repeatedly in the literature, and therefore it's sad to say, but we have protocols for this. You know, you develop protocols for dealing with situations like this. So when we talk about it, we have to start with source number two. Now, in preparing this, I wanted to make sure that we wouldn't run into a situation where I had to rush through everything and we could actually have a conversation. So I omitted the sources that are traditionally brought that are irrelevant. In other words, the ones that you bring in order to defeat them. I'm sorry? Oh, I'm bringing the ones that are here on the sheet. Not to worry. What I'm omitting are the sources that are cited that you can dismiss. So I'm gonna rat you out to Mrs. Goldberg. You should know. For example, there's a case biblically involving a man by the name of Sheva bin Bichri, who was a fugitive from the law, and he ran into a town to escape King David's forces, and they surround the town, and they say, either turn him over, or we're going to wipe out the town. And that case is often cited in part of a discussion about the community's needs versus the needs of the individual. That's one example. But again, it's not relevant to our case because he was a criminal who was wanted already from before that. What we're talking about is when people are taken hostage who have done nothing wrong whatsoever. And the question now is, should the community spend its funds in order to ransom them, knowing that you're depleting community funds, and potentially, you're also going to inspire the criminals to take more hostages. There are more factors, but that's the basic question. How do I balance the needs? So take a look, please, at source number two. Source number two goes back to the Mishnah, so you're dealing with a text that's canonized in the 3rd century, although it's much older than that. And it says the following, "Ein podin es hashvuyin yeser al kidei demehen." We do not redeem captives for more than their value, due to tikkun ha'olam, for the sake of repair of the world. Okay, what questions should we be asking when we look at this source?
How do you figure the value?
Yeah, one question is, what does value mean? Right? Who do you ask? You have to, right, you have to do an evaluation. You have to do an appraisal, and we'll you know.
Is this value in monetary terms, or?
Purely monetary.
Purely monetary.
But the question still is, what does that mean, right? You can evaluate somebody's value, you know, in a number, even financial value, in a number of different ways, right? How might we calibrate someone's value?
Their income, their assets.
Income and assets.
Well, those things, how much they would sell for it in the slave market, you know.
What like they would go for in the slave market?
Standing.
Sorry?
Standing within the community.
Standing, well, that's not a financial.
We can't.
Their value to the community, value to the Jewish nation.
Yeah, but that's hard to quantify.
Right. How do you put a number? No. I mean, we're trying to come up with hard numbers.
Insurance. Life insurance.
Right, we have to figure the policies that are outstanding. If they didn't have kidnapping insurance, right?
Yeah. Everything there that you mentioned, that everybody's mentioned, is a soft number. Because there's a value that you would put, there's a value he put, there's a value he put. There's no thought
Well, no. If you say slave market,
we call that value to owner.
If you say slave market value, as you know, hard as it is for us to, I hope, relate to such a thing, but there's a number. When they bring this person to the market, they know what he's going to sell for. That's what we're talking about. Or the other person's assets. So you have a system, and you say, well, let's calculate and what the land would be worth on the market, and maybe we have to figure what it would be worth today, what it would be worth in another season, whatever it is. But you know, make your calculation. The truth of the matter is that this is indeed debated, but the general position, as Mark had said, is indeed that we evaluate based on their slave market. And the reason for it is simple. Because what we're talking about is saving a person from being sold into slavery. So what we're saying is, the community will purchase the person and set them free. That's the idea. Now, you'll say, well, that means then that if they demand more than that, we're just going to let them become slaves? And the answer is, it sounds like the answer is yes. Why? Because of this other half of the sentence, tikkun ha'olam, repair of the world. What does that mean?
Stop those guys from being in the kitchen.
How are you stopping them?
They'll know that it's not a profitable thing to do, so they'll stop doing it.
Well, no, because then we can just go to the market and buy it on the open market. If they're trying to sell it for the in the same market, so you can, the actual trade is that we can go to the same market and purchase it for that price.
Right.
So therefore, they're not going to gain anything by refusing to be ransomed at that price.
Well, that assumes that we actually have access to that market. In other words, what they'll often do is they're going to go place to place kidnapping people and then bring them all. You know, it's right. I mean, it depends if they're wholesalers or retailers.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's part of the question. But the point is, and this is how we come to setting the value, if my goal in ransoming them but not paying too much is that I want to avoid inspiring them to take more captives, then really the cap is whatever they would get on the slave market. If I'm going to pay a dollar more than they would get on the slave market, or frankly, even if I pay exactly what they would get on it, then I'm inspiring them to take more captives. That's how we come up with this number. It's not that we really believe a human being is worth whatever they could be sold for. It's simply that that's the cap on what we can do without making this a profitable business. We don't want it to be
super profit.
No, it will be profitable for them, assuming they're good at what they do. Which you know is part of any business calculation. But that's the issue of value. Now, what we don't address here, and I didn't go into here, but it's very important as a piece of the discussion, is triage. Right? Let's say they're holding 50 people hostage, and they're willing to ransom them for market value. I don't have the ability to ransom 50 people. I can ransom 10. How do I pick which ones I'm going to ransom? What do you say?
Well, I have an earlier question. Do we have a duty, first of all, to try and free them otherwise before we go to the ransom? Or is there a hierarchy in the sense that if we could, let's say, muster a muster people to go try and try and buy force.
Right. So
is there an obligation there?
Right. You reminded me of a class I taught, one of the first classes I ever taught in a community. Yeshiva University has a program during the summers called the Summer Torah Seminar, where they send out rabbinical students to communities around North America to teach classes for a week or two. So this was in Baltimore. And I'm teaching a class on the issue of Yehareg Val Yavor, which means there's usually the rule is that every mitzvah is overridden in order to save one's life. If a person holds a gun to a Jew's head and says, either eat the ham sandwich or I'm going to kill you, the answer is eat the ham sandwich. There are exceptions to the rule. And that was what I was discussing. What are the exceptions to this rule? Where would one need to give up his life? So I gave this situation of the gun to the fellow's head as a Russian fellow sitting at the class. And, you know, I had just laid this out. Like, so do you eat the sandwich or do you let him kill you? And he says, you grab the gun and you shoot him. The reality is that for Jews living in Roman times, the idea of mustering forces was not really such an option. There are some cases. There's a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud where it talks about the sage Reish Lakish, who began as a brigand, as a highwayman, before becoming a sage. And so he had a little bit of a knowledge of the way this works. He had a skill set, thank you. So there's one story where one of the sages is actually taken captive, and the other sages say, let's prepare his shrouds, like, it's all over. And he says, what do you mean it's all over? And he's going to play action hero and go save him. So there is such a possibility discussed, but it was rare that that was an option. But the answer to your question in general is, look, if your chances are good, and you have to define good, then it's like any other intervention, like medical intervention or whatever, we have a responsibility to try to do so. But in terms of how we do the triage, so there are sources. I could have brought you an extra sheet, and we could have discussed that, the sources on it. But there's one system of evaluation in which we look at the person's value to the community. And we say, how important is this person? How important is their role to the community? So that the Talmud discusses, so that they two different Kohanim, priests, that hold different positions. The one who is more needed for the community is the one who will be ransomed first. So there are methods of evaluation. It's a longer discussion, but it's also worth recognizing that has to be part of how we address this. Take a look at source number 3, please. Source number 3 picks up on number 2. It's the sages discussing that Mishnah that said we don't do more than their value. Iba Yalahu. So sages ask the question. Hai mipnei tikkun ha'olam. When you say it's tikkun ha'olam, repair of the world. Mishum duchka de tziburahu, odila mishum de lo ligravu v'laisu tfei. There are two ways we can look at this. Is it because of straining the community, burdening the community on this ransom? In other words, they're demanding, I'm going to make up numbers, they're demanding $1 million to ransom this individual. Is the problem with raising this $1 million? Or is the problem that once you've paid this $1 million, as we said now, they're going to keep on doing this because it's a lucrative business? So they answer, by the way, what will be the ramifications? What will be the ramifications of the distinction between whether it's about this or whether it's about the future? Why does this question matter?
Well, because if it's actually for the future, they're going to keep on doing this, then why go pay the ransom? There's no point in paying it. As opposed to if it's a one-time occurrence, whereas whether the community as a whole can raise the money, pay it off, and it's done with, and it potentially won't happen again, then the question is just a strict monetary burden as opposed to.
So Jonathan wants to go even further than the Talmud did and said, if you're concerned about the future, you shouldn't even ransom the first time at all. To which the answer would be, yeah, but they're getting this money anyway. Whether they sell them to you or they sell them on the slave market, he's getting the money regardless. But one difference would be, yeah.
But you don't want to encourage them.
So they're getting it anyway. What I'm willing to pay them, they're going to get. And therefore, they're going to get that degree of encouragement regardless. It's going the dollar more that I couldn't do.
Well, you know, a lot of people disagree with that because, take, for example, in Congress.
Yeah.
There's a law in the United States that you're not allowed to pay off a terrorist.
Right.
For ransom or otherwise, because if you do that, they'll not keep on doing it.
What
they say, no matter what, they know But do what you like, you're not getting paid.
Right, but what's the difference between that case and our case? There's a big difference.
They're going to kill him, they're not going to sell him.
Exactly. In that case, the case that you're talking about with modern terrorism, which we have to get to, the alternative for them is not selling the person on the slave market. They're just going to shoot them and that's it. Whenever they get tired of feeding them is when they're going to end their lives. The case here, they're getting money anyway. So that's a key difference. But I'll offer you three differences between these two explanations. Number one, what if someone wants to ransom himself? Under the argument of this is a burden on the community, it's not a burden. I have the money. I'll do it. But under the argument of what's going to happen tomorrow, I'm not allowed to ransom myself even. Because if I do, then they're going to take more captives in the future, relying on them to ransom themselves. They'll just be very careful about who they pick. They're going to pick the people who have the wallet. That's one difference. Another difference is, what if there's reason to believe that they will not take more captives? That this is, in fact, a one-shot deal. There's a special circumstance. This person was taken captive, but ransoming them is not going to lead to future kidnappings. Or, flip side, another ramification, what about if they're going to take more captives regardless of what I do in this case? Because that's what they do. So even if I don't ransom this one, it's not going to make a difference. So you have to ask, which is my explanation? The Talmud continues here in source number 3 with a story. Come and hear, the Talmud says. We're going to bring you a proof. They mention a fellow known to them named Levi Bar Darga. And Levi Bar Darga, parka lebrate, betleser alfei dinrei zahav. Levi Bar Darga, son of someone named Darga, redeemed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinar, which to them was known as more than market value. Whatever market value was, this was huge. In general, when the Talmud brings a number of 12,000 or 13,000, it's understood that it just means a really, really large number. It's non-specifics. Tosfot on the Talmud makes that comment. So they ransom for this huge amount of money. So that seems to demonstrate that the concern is a concern for burden on the community, and therefore, since he had the money himself, he said, I'm going to do it. And the concern was not about what happens in the future. Because otherwise he wouldn't have been licensed to do this. You follow? The argument is, if he was able to pay the money, clearly our concern is not about the future, our concern is about right now. To which the Talmud says, why in the world do you think that he followed the rules? Right. Abaye, another sage, argued, who says the sages agree with this? Perhaps he did it against the desire of the sages. His daughter was being held hostage, right?
That's the point. The point is, in my opinion, what they said it would actually happen is it had nothing to do with today, tomorrow, the amount. It's his child, it's his family, and he would pay whatever he had to get it loose.
Right, and that's what Abaye suggests, that you can't draw any conclusions from there, and that's the end of the discussion here in the Talmud. The Talmud does not give us a verdict. That's why I brought you source number 4.
Because stickers are not done.
Take a look at, maybe not, you could argue both ways, but take a look at source number 4, where Maimonides, writing 1,000 years after this story, gives you a rule. He says, "Ein podin et hashvuyim b'yeter al demehen b'nei tikkun ha'olam." We do not redeem captives for more than their value for society's sake. Or that's the way I translated there. I don't know why I didn't just write "repair of the world" again, sloppy. But it's for the repair of the world. That's really the words that he used. Shelo yiyu ha'oyvim rodfin achareihem lishbosam, lest the enemy pursue them to capture them. In other words, he says the concern really is about the future. And therefore, in the Levi Bar Darga case, he really shouldn't have done it. He did it anyway, because he wasn't about to listen to people tell him not to. In other words, though, there is a cap. And the cap is because we are concerned about society being expected to pay for this person in the future. Why does society trump the needs of the individual who's right there on the spot and pleading, help me, save me? Why is society override?
That's your creed.
But why? What's the rationale?
Rationality is because, you know, one individual is not as important as the whole community.
Right. One way to look at it is that there are more individuals in the society than there are in, you know, being held hostage right now. There are 5 people or 50 people being held hostage, and there are thousands of people in the community. The needs of the thousands of people will override the needs of these few individuals. Can you see a scenario in which that would not be true?
Depends on who the individuals are.
Yeah,
depends who the individuals are. Sometimes we're going to say the individuals override. Sorry?
That is the example before, that the person in the, giving the share of
Valiable. Why would that?
Because they in the normal circumstances, you'd say, certainly, we can't give the guy in. You know, if you have to kill us all, we can't give him up. However, because he would happen to be in Russia, he could. So that depends on the person. If that's the riot, then it depends on the person as opposed to anything else.
I don't know.
Because if he was a Tzaddik, for example,
yeah,
then that whole law would not apply.
Is it? No, this is talking about him and his own life.
What I'm trying to say is the community that proves that the community that what the community says doesn't always to say the community is not the most important thing. Okay. So one is an individual is a tzaddik, is in the city, and they say if you don't give up the scar.
Oh, that's what you're asking. Okay, now I understand what you're asking about. The case in which he's in the city, but there we say that you give up the individual.
Only if he's not in Russia.
No, what Jerry's talking about is the following. It's an extension of the discussion about the criminal that I said I wasn't getting into before. That one. That's fine. What the Talmud there says is, assuming that evildoers of some kind surround a city, and they say, we're going to wipe out the city unless you hand over X person. The rule is you hand over the person. In the event that they say, we're going to kill everybody in the city unless you hand over somebody,
we don't care who, right?
Then you don't hand over the person, unless you're talking about somebody who was a criminal who's on death row anyway. But the governing principle there is because he's dead regardless. What allows me to hand over the individual where they name the individual is because in either scenario he's dead. Whether I hand him over and they kill him, or whether I don't hand him over and they kill everybody, his life is over. Ditto for the case of the person who's on death row, where they don't name somebody. But if they don't name somebody at all, I can't hand over a random person, because if I hand it over somebody else, that person could. So I don't have the right to end their life to save everybody. So just the opposite, it demonstrates that the society will not necessarily override the needs of the individual. But I want to go further with this.
I was thinking of the lady talking about when you said that.
Right, and
that's another stuff.
Yes, it is.
One last comment. Could my money is actually held by both reasonings? Because the way he's actually worded is, he says, may political or not. There could be the second reason also because of less. Less at the end of the student. Because he's basically putting the Mishnah. He's basically. And then he adds on, he has an addition.
Right, but it's the way. Right, but
they have actually agreed both sides. Translating Tikkun Olam as meaning for the community, and then afterwards. Putting that as an extra.
Right, but if you go back to source number 3, you see that was actually a definition of Tikkun Olam presented that way. Okay. And that's what he's doing. Yeah.
Okay.
Mark.
Does there any kind of difference whether or not they're holding a person for ransom, and if you don't ransom, they just going to sell on the slave market, or whether they say either ransom or we kill them?
Yes. So we're going to come to that. Okay. So what we've seen so far among our primary sources indicates that we have a cap, and society's needs trump the needs of the individual. But take a look now at source number 5, Jerry's source. Talmud says, regarding a husband's obligation to his wife, there are various obligations the husband takes on upon getting married, and one of them is to ransom his wife if she's taken captive. How much does he have to pay? So the Talmud there says, Nishbeis v'hayu mevakshin mimenu ad asar bedameha. If a man's wife is taken captive and they seek even 10 times her value, Pam Rishona Poda, the first time round he has to pay whatever. What happens the second time round? So the answer is he has to pay. No, then he has to pay the regular amount, and other people will have to chip in to make it up. And that's a discussion in its own right there in the Talmud. But my point in bringing it was not so that Jerry should have a laugh. My point was that the statement here is, you pay way more than the person's value. What happened to the rule that we said, that we don't go over a person's value? That's question number 1. Question number 2, take a look at the story in source number 6. I'm going to say quickly outside of the text, you can see it there yourself though. This is during the period right after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and the Romans have taken large numbers of people captive. These are not highwaymen doing it. This is official Roman legions who have taken people captive and are planning to sell them as slaves. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah is a sage, and he goes to Rome. And he's told that there is a Jewish child there being held captive, and he hears wonderful descriptions about the child, which the Talmud presents in terms of the child's physical beauty. Although, as we see as the story plays out, the child is exemplary in terms of scholarship, religious scholarship, and righteousness. And he says, this is a person of incredible talent. I'm going to redeem him for any price they demand. And as the story continues in the Talmud, he does. And the result is, this young man is actually Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, who became a great sage, leader of his generation. End of the first century Common Era. So the point in this is that Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah has no problem paying, no matter the price. So how do we resolve the conflict between sources, where on the one hand we're told, no, there's a cap, and on the other hand, in these two cases, we say, whatever they ask. So the answer is, if you flip the page, you'll see material on it, that there may be overriding concerns which compel us to spend more. And this is going to take us towards the ISIS discussion as well. Example number one for what might be an overriding concern goes back to the point that Mark raised in source number 7, Tosfot, set of commentaries to the Talmud, as you see, I wrote there, 13th century Western Europe. Writing on that passage in which Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah says, I will redeem him for whatever they ask. He says, why? Because when there is a threat to life, when it's not just about being sold as a slave, but it's they're going to kill him, then we redeem them for more than their value. That's his first answer. And then he gives a second answer, which we're going to mention as well, which is, it's because he saw that this boy, Rabbi Yishmael, well, not rabbi at the time, Yishmael ben Elisha, was very sharp, and he said, this is a boy who's going to excel and become a leader in the Jewish world, and therefore I'm going to pay more for him now. So those are two reasons. Now, I should note, not everybody agrees with Tosfot in his first half here when he says you redeem captives to save their lives. Nachmanides, who knew all about this, he lived in 13th century Christian Spain, disagreed and said no. He said, life and death does not override, the needs of the community still trump. But we've seen here two arguments for overriding the cap. One argument is the life and death case, potentially, subject to dispute. And the other is where this person is somebody of great standing, somebody who could be of value to the community. Another would be if somebody wanted to save himself. Let's say somebody wanted to save himself. Are you really going to say he can't do that? If you take a look at source number 8, another commentary from Tosfot, and by the way, when you remember, you're dealing with 13th century Western Europe. Again, these are people, the authors of the commentaries that are Tosfot, are very familiar with these sorts of situations. This is not an ivory tower hypothetical conversation for them. So they write, regarding the case of ransoming one's wife, what's the justification? Because, he says, when it comes to redeeming oneself, you're allowed to pay whatever amount. And they quote a verse from Job, that a person would give all of his money to save his life, to save his own life. So he says, well, one's wife is like oneself. So therefore, one would be justified in paying more to ransom his wife, like we saw in source number 5. And one would be justified then also in redeeming himself for more. So that's another case in which we would override the concerns for the community, even though you know that what's coming down the line is potentially more kidnappings that are going to harm the community. I'll give you another example, source number 9, that really brings us into the modern age. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, writing in the 20th century in Israel, justifying a decision by the Israeli government to ransom people, to ransom soldiers who are being held captive. He says, you know why they decided to go ahead with the deal? Neged einei hamemshala shechlita, amda nekuda chashuva nosefet. He says, those who had to make this decision recognized an additional important point. V'hi ha-moral shel chayalei tzahal, the morale of the soldiers in the Israel Defense Force. Kasher chayal yodaya shemipol mishavi medinat Yisrael, or it should be bishavi probably, medinat Yisrael kula nitzebet me'acharav l'shach boro. He says, when a soldier knows that if he should be taken captive, everybody is going to stand behind him to free him, whatever the cost, yimsor nafsho b'shat krav lo pachad u'mora, he will risk his life in battle without fear. There's a certain sense of...
they have my back.
They have, yeah. So therefore, we need to have the soldiers be aware that we'll do this for them. This similar logic is employed when they discuss taking care of healthcare workers during an epidemic. Right? Like in the Ebola crisis, the question was, you know, who do we give our treatments to first? And the answer is, if you don't give your treatments to your healthcare workers, they're not going to go. They need to be aware that if something goes wrong and they get infected, you're going to be looking out for them. So it's the same idea. So that would be another overriding concern. And then finally, source number 10, Bishat Churban HaBayit. The other point that Tosfot makes is that they're at a time when they're going to take more captives anyway, such as the Roman destruction of the Second Temple. It doesn't matter, you know, what the impact is in the future. It's all, they're going to keep on taking captives anyway. So we have these various exceptions: saving oneself, saving somebody of great value to the community, saving a life, the soldiers. We have all of these overriding elements. What are the justifications for these exceptions? What justifies overriding concern for the community in order to save someone's life, as opposed to just saving him from captivity? Why is it that we're going to override it in order to save somebody's life?
Because his blood's greater than yours.
Well, greater than the community's. We already said numbers matter. I wouldn't say it's about blood being redder. I think it's about knowledge, about certainty versus possibility. Right? Certainty versus possibility, I think, is a bigger issue. Meaning, I know for sure that if I don't ransom him, he's dead. I don't know for sure what's happening tomorrow. You follow? Mm-hmm. So therefore, better for me to save his life now and hope that tomorrow isn't a bad day. That's one...
regardless if he's haham or not so haham.
Yeah, whether he's you know, wise or not wise, useful to the community, that's the argument, is just the fact that you're talking about life and death. You know he's dead. We can't risk that.
Is it number 10 basically refraining the time of the destruction, basically? Is anybody? I mean, do you need to still go through the hierarchy, or whoever you can save, you save? The reason I'm asking is, for example, Kastner in Hungary with the train.
Yeah.
Where he picked where he was. Is there still a hierarchy when it comes
to... there still is triage. Yeah. So that's one. That's one. That's when it comes to doing this in order to save a life. In terms of saving oneself, why do we say that a person would be allowed to save himself? What's the rationale? Because you can't expect otherwise. Right? You can't expect the person, seriously, to forfeit himself because of concern that otherwise they're going to kidnap more people in the future. It's unrealistic. In the justification for saving the leader, this future leader, or saving the soldiers, the needs of the many often are the needs of the few. Okay?
There's depending on the circumstances.
Meaning?
For example, in a war.
Yeah.
What you do in a war is you're not going to do anything else other than kill the other side, right? That's what you do. So if you capture somebody, right, and then you say, look, I'll give him up, and say in those circumstances the community may be less important than the aims of what the whole idea of whether it's a war going
on. I'm going to come back to that. Hold on. But let's apply this to ISIS captives from what we've said so far. Based on what we've said, would we say to ransom them or not?
So far, yes, you
would. Why?
Because you get all the riots. Why you have to do it?
Why?
Because because they could sell them to somebody else.
No, they're not selling anybody.
You're talking about ISIS.
Yeah.
Well, no, then you don't do it at all because they're going to get killed anyway.
Right. No, no, you do it.
Because of it.
The point is that they're going to get killed. Following that view of Tosfot, right, that we mentioned in source number 7, you know, they don't let people go. That's not happening. So
but even when you ransom them, they don't.
No, no, oh, yeah, they're released a lot.
Yeah, they're no French, German, they're
the ransom. Right. So, and there's no concern about this might inspire them to take more captives.
Because they're already inspired.
Because they're taking more captives regardless.
It's like the Somali pirates.
Yes. But there's a major difference. There are two arguments to be brought against ransoming. One is what Jerry said before. If you take a look at source number 11, authorities in Jewish law have been bothered by the fact that Jewish law allows for, and even in certain cases encourages, war. Because normally we say you have to protect your life and save your life and so on, but in a time of war, you know that people going out have to expect they could lose their lives. And so Rabbi Yosef Babad offered the following logic in source number 11. He said, "Nihi dechol ha-mitzvos nidchos v'bnei ha-sakana," granted that all the mitzvot, all the commandments are overridden in the face of danger. Nonetheless, he says, "Mikomako mitzvah zu ha-Torah tzivta l'lchom imahem," the Torah instructed us with this mitzvah that we should go to war. "V'yadua de-ha-Torah lo tismoch dinei al-hanes," you know the Torah is not saying, well, don't worry, you'll just rely on miracles and everybody's going to come back alive. That's not the way that Jewish law works. And he says, people in fact die on both sides. Nonetheless, we do it. So he says, what we're seeing is that war is a thing unto itself. It doesn't follow the normal rules. And therefore, the argument goes, we would not redeem captives, because it's understood that this is the way, during war, that's not our focus. Our focus is not redeeming people, our focus is fighting. If you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was one of the leading authorities in Jewish law in the world at the time of the Dawson's Field hijacking that we mentioned in the beginning. And he was asked by those who had raised the funds and wanted to ransom Rabbi Huttner, he was asked, so should we do it? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is here quoted by Rabbi Shlomo Aviner in an article available online, as I noted. And he said, "Hagon Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Shaba America, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in America, Amar Berayon Shahuala Basot Iska Bedvar Gaon Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner Shamatos Hachiyuv Biyardein." He says, "Yeah, it should be Hachatuf. I think that's a typo. I couldn't figure out what to do with Hachiyuv." He says, regarding this question of ransoming Rabbi Huttner and the idea that had been suggested. So he says, "B'milchama ein din pidyon shvuyim ela din milchama." He says, during war, it's not about ransoming captives. It's a law of war. "V'lo nichnaim v'lo asim maso matan." We are not humbled. We do not bargain. "Ela nilchamim v'tokfim." We fight and attack. And his argument was that was considered to be a time of war, even though there was no formal war between two sides. Nonetheless, he said, that's viewed as a time of war, and therefore we do not ransom. And indeed, he said, do not ransom Rabbi Huttner. That's one argument that's brought. Now,
Rabbi Huttner wasn't an Israeli citizen. I mean, who is he at war with?
So that's the whole question of how you define war is a really good question. But his argument is that this is actually, this is 1970. Most of the world wasn't thinking in those terms. But he's arguing that this is a war against Jews. That was the way that he looked at it.
Because they're separated.
Right. That's one argument. But there's also an additional argument, which Rabbi Herschel Schachter notes in an article in Or HaMizrach, in source number 13, that Rabbi Kamenetsky also brought, which is directly relevant for the ISIS discussion, separate from the discussion of war. He says, "V'ta'an az hagon Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, de'ena cheshbona zet sodek bichlal." Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky claimed this calculation of saying, well, Rabbi Huttner is of superlative value and therefore we should redeem him. He says, it's wrong. Why? "D'chol ha'chdina de'pidyon shvuyim lasa ele b'sha'at shalom." Like we said in number 12, this law of ransoming people and all that, that's in a time of peace. He says, during war, you don't stop fighting in order to pay ransom. So far, the same as number 12, but then he adds, We'd then be assisting the enemy during the battle. If you give ISIS millions of dollars to ransom someone, where's that millions of dollars going?
More arms.
It's going to fuel their operation. So that's the other problem. And that, I think, is really what wins the day, philosophically, is know that by saving this person's life, you are directly enabling them to take more lives. And that is where we get stuck. So to sum up very quickly what we've said, over 45 minutes in like 45 seconds, but we said there's this long history of dealing with hostage-taking issues within Judaism, where our major primary source says not to redeem for more than their value out of concern that they might take more captives. On the other hand, we do have sources like ransoming one's wife, or the ransom of Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, which said, no, we do ransom, even for more than their value. We offered a number of explanations, overriding factors, which may militate for ransoming, such as saving a life, saving someone from imminent death, because that's a certainty, as opposed to concern for what might happen in the future. Saving oneself, because it's not realistic to expect people not to. Saving a leader or saving the soldiers because of their value to the community. There are these justifications for overriding it. On that basis, so far, we would have said, yes, ransom the people being held by ISIS to save their lives. And don't worry about inspiring them for the future, because they're doing it anyway. But we have these two last concerns. Number one, in war, you can't stop to ransom people. That's not what happens during war. And number two is that you can't give them money that they will use to fuel their operation. I'm going to be in touch with Jonathan to discuss whether we have or we do not have a class on the last Wednesday in April. Stay tuned. I will let everybody know if we're using our email list, God willing. And then, either way, hopefully, at least at the end of May, we will have another one.
Okay, so according to this, you tell me that the Israel government shouldn't be negotiating.
And giving them more.
So,
well, in this situation where, let's say, where they negotiate to have the bodies of a few soldiers come back.
No, basically,
they're doing it based on the other thing.